Welcome to the New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore podcast, where twice a month we explore the world of New Hampshire that lies outside of the hard news. I'm your host, Wayne King, and I invite you to join us for an adventure that will take us on a journey together to explore those things that are unlikely to make the pages of your newspaper, the waves of your radio station, or the bits and bytes of your favorite news website. Yet for many of us, these stories will reveal what makes life here in the Granite State truly worth living. Together we'll uncover some secrets, speculate on a few rumors and legends, and we'll meet the people and a critter or two, both living and long departed, who weave together the colorful tapestry of New Hampshire's past, as well as some who are helping to build our future. We'll explore places known and unknown that you will want to add to your bucket list. We'll laugh together, gasp together, and maybe even shed a tear or two.
Heart of New Hampshire, the geographic center of the state, is a beautiful meandering river that is the focal point of a very special community of people and a landscape that grows into the heart like a spreading wildfire. The original natives of the region, at least those within the last few thousand years, the people whom we know as Abenaki, called it Osquamchamaki, a beautiful and poetic name meaning place of mountain waters, or place where the salmon spawn, depending on which interpretation of the words you choose. Flowing down from the southwestern heights of the Musalak Range, it is an archetype of a river flowing freely along the valleys in the southern foothills of New Hampshire's White Mountains, to the east of the Upper Valley region, beginning with the fast-flowing waters tumbling down from the region around Mount Musalak, and ending in broad, lugubrious oxbows, where it meets the Pemigewasset River in Plymouth. Anyone who has canoed the Baker or climbed Rattlesnake Mountain or hiked Mount Cube, anyone who has bicycled or driven along the Buffalo Road, can't help but fall in love with this area. If the landscape isn't enough, the people will seal the deal for you. Pragmatic, serious-minded in their politics, and deeply devoted to their families. People who work hard, play hard, and who immerse themselves joyfully in the life of their community and the other communities of the valley. Osquamchamaki. This was the name that my father's ancestors, or more accurately, my great-grandmother's ancestors, my ancestors, gave to this river and the valley through which it flowed. These are people among a confederation of tribes we generally refer to as Abenaki. The Abenaki were part of a larger New England-wide confederacy known as Wabanaki, people of the Dawn Land. Today, we believe that they have lived in the state for nearly 10,000 years, perhaps longer. Here's Doug McLean, who grew up in Manchester and now resides in Plymouth. Doug is a former biology teacher and now a businessman in Plymouth. Both Doug and his father were amateur archaeologists with a particular interest in the native people of New Hampshire.
Yeah, there were a lot of Native Americans here way back to before we had any names to even put on them. They were, as you may know, my dad was the amateur archaeologist in Manchester who discovered the Smith site, which is, so he knocked on the door of what used to be John Stark's house right down there by where the Amiskag Bridge touches the east bank of the river and just above the dam in Manchester. He knocked on the door and said, the new bridge is going to wipe your house out. Actually, it got moved up onto Elm Street. Do you mind if we dig up your yard? And the guy, they said no. And it turned out to be, it was no bigger than the footprint of your living room. And it turned out to be the richest site basically ever found in New England. And when they got 6 feet down of topsoil, so you know around here, you're lucky if you get 6 inches of topsoil. They had 6 feet of topsoil from humans living there, drying their salmon, the charcoal that was left behind. They ran into the glacial layer, found charcoal from a fire pit, set it to have a carbon-14 dated. And the response, and I still got it, it says, there must have been contamination because there were no humans then. It dated out at 7,500 years old. Uh-huh. They sent a second sample, and they wrote back and said, you've just registered the earliest date of Homo sapiens east of the Mississippi.
Wow.
Right there in Manchester. Now, that date has since been passed a number of times. These archaic Native Americans who hadn't, long before, come over the Bering Bridge in Alaska into North America, probably migrated east, made some of the fanciest tools found. Some of the fanciest artifacts they found were at the very, very deepest, oldest layers.
Now, Doug was speaking about a site along the Merrimack River in Manchester, a site almost 60 miles downriver from the Asquam-Chemaki River and the Asquam-Chemaki Valley. A site that was also once home to the Stark family. Okay, so stay with me here. We're going to bring all this together before we're done today, but in order to tell you this tale and to speculate on a special relationship between the Stark family and the Abenaki people, one that may well have extended over time, we need to go back a bit farther in time. Now, as I said, the Asquam-Chemaki Valley ran from the Mount Musilauk region to its junction with the Pemigewasset River in what today is Plymouth, New Hampshire. The name of the river was changed after 1712, when Lieutenant Thomas Baker and a patrol of 35 rangers attacked and obliterated a peaceful village of Abenaki from a small tribal group known as the Pemigewasset. Details of the attack from records are sketchy and involve competing narratives. Oral accounts passed down over the years among the Abenaki seem to indicate that most of the men from the village were hunting at the time of the attack, and that the Indians killed were largely women and children. But we know from written records that the village's sachem, its spiritual leader, Watonumus, was among those killed, and that the shots that killed him came from Baker himself. We also know from other records that Baker was likely engaged in a sort of blood feud with Watonumus. As a younger man, Watonumus had been a leader of the Abenaki in the Deerfield Raid during the earlier French and Indian War, a raid that captured Baker as a 19-year-old, and brought him to Quebec, a prisoner of the French, until he was ransomed back 2 years later. But on the banks of the Asquam-Chemaki and Pemigewasset Rivers, on that fateful day, Thomas Baker and his troops took no prisoners. The entire village was destroyed, and the troops of Baker suffered no recorded losses. They also returned to their base in Northampton, Massachusetts, with a wealth of beaver and deer pelts, as well as salmon, stolen from the village, in addition to what was estimated to be 20 to 30 scalps of the dead, for which they were paid £40 sterling. Thomas Baker was promoted to captain, and ultimately the river was renamed in his honor. Other than this incident, labeled a battle by the British records and a massacre by the Abenaki, including the very few Pemigewasset Indians that remained after returning to find their village burned and their families dead, there is no record, no public record anyway, of any heroic exploits by Thomas Baker, either before or after the incident. Nor is there any record of him being promoted again, despite the fact that he was a career officer. For all of the years that followed, right up to the present day, in spite of the official action that changed the name of the river and the valley through which it flowed, the people of this valley have preserved the Abenaki name. Even the local chapter of the vaunted Daughters of the American Revolution is known as the Asquamchemaki Chapter. There are snowmobile clubs, shooting ranges, clubs and societies, all bearing the name Asquamchemaki, a quiet testament to those who rejected the official name change. In other ways, both small and large, the citizens of the area have demonstrated their commitment and love for this valley and this river. In 1969, when the U.S. Congress established the very first Earth Day, the valley of the Asquamchemaki was prominently in the minds of local people. In the early 1970s, shortly after the establishment of Earth Day by congressional action, led by a group of individuals that included the storied Senator Gaylord Nelson and a local New Hampshire environmental hero named Sid Howe, I was guiding backpacking and canoe trips in the White Mountains for Camp Mowgli, School of the Open, on Newfound Lake. Every summer from 1970 to 1982, I would oversee river cleanups on both the Pemigewasset and the Asquamchemaki rivers, removing tons of debris, tires, and trash each time. I was not alone. Other independent actions by environmental leaders in our communities, Dr. Larry Spencer and Dr. Lisa Doner of Plymouth State University, both tell us of numerous cleanups on the Asquamchemaki / Baker River and the Pemigewasset River, with hundreds of Plymouth State students and citizens involved. A separate movement among local citizens, including my own parents, and other local environmental leaders like Pat and Tom Schlesinger of New Hampton and Dr. Larry Cushman of Rumney joined together to advocate for an end to dumping pollutants and sewage into the river by the mills and the towns along their paths. These people were trailblazers who took great personal risks and endured threats to their homes and their personal safety. All of these activities helped to reverse the terrible degradation of the rivers during the earlier years of the 20th century. Here's Dr. Larry Spencer, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Plymouth State University.
Am I correct to say that you were involved in actual volunteer-based cleanups
on both rivers over the years?
Yeah, yeah. And I think I mentioned to you one time that my kids and I put in, my wife and I put in with our canoe at the Baker Bridge, which is another story. That's a wonderful bridge that Henry pushed and you guys pushed.
Yeah.
What a good replacement. But in any case, we went down the river. By the time we got to the, where is now the Rotary Park, the canoe was so full of debris that there was no place for the kids or us to be in the canoe. So we sort of held onto the canoe and swam by the side of it, you know.
That would have been, what, the 70s?
Yeah, yeah.
Earth Day was barely even established, I think, at that
right.
point. One of the things that I've kind of gotten interested in is the notion that maybe over a period of time, to speak conservatively, we could reestablish Asquam-Chamaki as the name of the river that was that became the Baker River after a peaceful group of Pemigewasset were attacked.
Right. It's such an awful thing to call the river after a guy that committed genocide. I mean, it's like what we're going through with removing the statues of Confederate fighters in the South. I think we ought to do the same sort of thing here in New Hampshire, where we have this long heritage of indigenous people living here and living sustainably and what have you, and we ignore it by calling it the Baker River.
And here is Dr. Lisa Doner, an associate professor at Plymouth State University with the Environmental Science and Policy Center for the Environment at Plymouth State, with a more recent perspective.
So I used to, back when I was guiding trips in the Whites in the 70s and 80s, every summer I would take a couple of cleanup trips to the Baker and the Pemi. And then I heard that you had gotten somehow involved with that recently. Is that correct?
Yes. It was not so much myself as a gentleman named Mark Tursky, who is a professor at Plymouth State University.
Huh.
And Mark was teaching a lot of environmental students and wanted to engage them in outdoor activities. And so he had learned about Ocean Cleanup Day. And well, maybe it's National Oceans Day, but it was basically ocean-based. And it turns out that because all rivers dump into the ocean, part of the ocean cleanup involved river cleanup. And so by signing up to participate in the Ocean Cleanup Day, he was able to get rubber gloves and plastic bags and signage to put out there. And he recruited students to engage in this big national effort. And we had multiple canoes and multiple life vests and paddles. And so some students had never been out on a river before. They'd never been in a boat before, but the Baker is a pretty gentle place to learn those skills. And we always did it in August or September. So the river was generally very low with lots of beach and shoreline exposed. Uh-huh. And once I came to Plymouth State, I eagerly joined the activities that he was organizing. But then he retired and I ended up with his canoes or with the canoes that had been used. They're actually a combination of private and public canoes. And so I was working with the Baker River Watershed Association at the time as a volunteer, and David Sod, who was then the president, had organized a river cleanup before I joined. and wanted to do it again. So I said, well, I can probably, you know, get some students to help with this, and I have canoes. So we did do it once.
And when would that have been?
I'm thinking it was like 2015.
Okay.
And then since then, there's been a number of things that have conspired to make it very difficult to organize another one. I think the next year we had a series, maybe we did it in 2016. In 2017, we had a series of floods and the river just stayed really high. It was too dangerous. And there wasn't really any exposed shoreline to stop and search for debris.
Right.
And then once your canoe gets heavy, it becomes dangerous if the current.
Right.
So we haven't done it since then.
Now, was there any, during that time, was there any movement toward trying to get the name of the river changed back to Asquamchemaki?
We weren't leading that effort. I know a number of people have been involved in such efforts. I think there's a lot of general interest. I don't know how much it would entail in terms of, I guess you'd have to petition the state.
You'd have to get the legislature to rename it.
Yeah. And show, you know, a reasonable amount of documentation that that's a useful thing to do. But I think in this year, especially, where diversity and equity and fairness are such a big part of what people are thinking, I think you'd find a lot of favorable support.
It seems to me that we could at least take the temperature of the public out there to see if there's some interest.
The other place you might look for support in getting this off the ground or getting some momentum on it is in the schools, the public schools.
Uh-huh.
Especially Rumney and Plymouth and yeah. You know, maybe Wentworth and Warren, but those are smaller schools. But I know the Plymouth schools tend to have teachers that get their students involved in civic engagement and civic projects.
Right, right.
And
that's a really good idea. It's a really interesting idea.
I'm thinking
idea.
About this because I actually own two Chinooks, and the Chinooks became named the New Hampshire state dog.
Right.
Because of an action of a class of, I think, elementary school students that researched it, and their teacher encouraged them to develop this into a proposal to the state.
Yeah.
And it happened.
Yeah. Well, when I was in the Senate, I think it was the 7th grade, it might have been the 4th grade, I've forgotten at this point, at Holderness Central, came to me with the idea of having a conservation license plate with a moose on it. Huh. And way back then we started, it took three, maybe even 4 years before we actually could pass it through the Senate and the House and it became law, but ultimately it became the moose plate.
Yeah, I got one.
Yeah, me too. So, yeah, kids can, and it's a great way for kids to get engaged. It's a great way. So, yeah, that's definitely worth pursuing. For all these reasons, and one more profound story that I will tell you in a moment, it seems fitting that we ask whether justice and moral authority should compel us to ask if we should restore the original name to this beautiful river and the valley. For thousands of years, these people and the nameless archaic tribes who preceded them had hunted and fished these lands, warring at times with the Iroquois,
but largely living in peace and creating trading routes and favored hunting grounds, running from the boreal forests of northern Canada to the sea. Now, it would be a mistake to think that after Columbus's wrong turn, relations were characterized by fighting between native people and European immigrants. Though there were certainly periods of conflict, they were often a result of conflicts between warring European powers, the French against the English most notable, into which native people were drawn because of their ongoing relationships with one country or another which dominated specific regions. One of the most interesting examples involves a family with a very familiar name, Stark. In 1720, Archibald Stark and his wife Eleanor embarked for America from his native Scotland in the company of many of his countrymen. The journey was long and difficult, and though the ship arrived in Boston in the late autumn, its cargo of immigrants were not allowed to debark because many of them were ill with smallpox. Instead, they were rerouted to Wiscasset, Maine, where they would spend the winter and finally find their way to New Hampshire, ultimately ending up in what is now Manchester. It's unlikely that you know the names of Archibald and Eleanor Stark, but you will likely know the name of their third child, John Stark, better known as Brigadier General John Stark, born in 1728. If not, you will certainly know his most famous quote, found on every New Hampshire license plate, "Live free or die." Uttered, they say, at the pivotal Battle of Bennington, but actually a quote read from a letter that Stark sent to a group when he was much older. If it had not been for his leadership, Stark's leadership, in that battle, along with 1,600 New Hampshire militiamen, personally recruited by Stark, it is quite possible that the efforts of the colonials would have failed. General John Stark was a bit of a recluse. It's quite likely that he is the most famous New Hampshire military hero of all time, and quite likely the Revolutionary War hero that we know the least about. This despite the fact that he was an officer at the Battle of Bunker Hill, that he crossed the Delaware with George Washington, he was at the Siege of Boston, the Battle of Trenton, and the Battle of Princeton, in addition to his courageous leadership in Bennington. He was a patriot, a farmer, and a woodsman, first and foremost, and a very private man. Biographers of George Washington often compare him to Cincinnatus, the Roman farmer-patriot, famed for his selfless service and his persistent desire to return to his farm and his private life. But many historians concur that Stark was a far more appropriate comparison. In addition to his service in the Revolution, John Stark was also second in command during the French and Indian War to Robert Rogers of the famed Rogers Rangers. The legendary warrior who founded what today we know as the Army Rangers. Rogers was famed as an Indian fighter. In fact, to the Iroquois people and the Abenaki both, he was referred to as Wobegonda, the White Devil. But Rogers was a complicated fellow. Even the Native Americans had a grudging respect for him. He dressed like an Indian, fought the way Indians fought really developed the stealthy techniques that allowed the colonists to win the war for independence. And he was very good friends with John Stark. In an odd sort of way, Robert Rogers was a prisoner of his time. And in another set of circumstances, things might have been different for him. It certainly seems that his relationship with John Stark was tested and provided some interesting twists along the way as a result of the many challenges that they faced working together as number one and two of Rogers Rangers. So by the time that the Stark family settled in Manchester, the attack on the Pemigewasset village that I've outlined previously and the renaming of the river had already happened. And by the time John Stark was born, the poetic name of the Asquamchemaki River had already been changed to the rather pedestrian Baker River. But here's where the story gets interesting. Along this same river, on April 28, 1752, John Stark and Amos Eastman were on a hunting trip in the town of Rumney when they were captured by Abenaki warriors and taken to St. Francis near Montreal. It seems clear that they were captured with the intent that they would be ransomed back, which was very common in those days. So Stark and Eastman were being held by the Abenaki in St. Francis, who decided to have some fun and make them run the gauntlet. Now, according to the legend, as Stark entered the gauntlet, he grabbed the first warrior's staff and began to fight back immediately, saying that he was going to kiss all their women and make love to all their women. And the warriors were so taken aback that he proceeded down the line until the end, with most of them flinching or being drawn away. The chief found this so brave and, I suspect, amusing, that he adopted Stark and Eastman into the tribe. And for the next half a year, they lived among the Abenaki until they were ransomed back to the U.S. Now recall, if you will, that John Stark was second in command of Rogers Rangers, famed Indian and backcountry fighters. Yet here he was, adopted into the Abenaki family, living with the Abenaki people in St. Francis for over a half a year, and feeling very welcomed. In fact, in later years, Stark would often speak with great fondness of his adopted family of Abenaki in St. Francis, though the historic record about that is quite sparse. At any rate, 6 years after returning to New Hampshire, something changed. Not with John Stark, but with relations between the English and the Abenaki. In 1759, Lord Geoffrey Amherst, the man for whom Amherst College would be named, issued an order for Robert Rogers' Rangers to attack St. Francis and destroy the village. This was not the first attack that Amherst had ordered upon the village of St. Francis. Amherst was one of the first British officers to employ smallpox-infected blankets against native people, and he had tested this idea out some years previous in St. Francis, calling for the extirpation of the natives. But this time he ordered a full-out assault on St. Francis. John Stark refused to participate. Though he was second in command in the Rangers, he told Robert Rogers that the Abenaki had shown him great kindness and that he would not make war on his adopted village. Now, in those days, this was a pretty serious offense to refuse to participate when you were one of the commanders of the forces. But clearly, something happened between John Stark and Robert Rogers that allowed him to continue in his leadership position, even though he would not go. In fact, what makes it even more interesting is that ultimately, even though Rogers is credited with destroying the village of St. Francis, because it occurred while most of the men were again on hunting expeditions, by the time Rogers' troops had returned to New Hampshire, almost the entire brigade had been wiped out by angry Abenakis in pursuit of the people who had destroyed St. Francis. So it may have gone in the historic win column for Robert Rogers, but the truth is that the results were equally devastating on both sides. And it may very well be that John Stark, had he participated, would not have survived to become the hero of Bennington in the Revolutionary War years later. This is an exceedingly interesting thread to follow, because Stark, by doing what he believed to be the right thing, positioned himself to save the Republic in its darkest hours. So it's natural that over time, legends would build up around John Stark's fondness for the Abenaki people. And these are the stories that we can really only speculate about. But the irony of the story that John Stark refused to participate in the raid on St. Francis and thereby lived to fight in the Revolutionary War, and in many ways bring about the outcome of that war for those of us who have lived in democracy for all these years hence cannot be outstated or understated. And that's the story of John Stark and the people of the Dawn Land. Thanks for joining us on New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore. Special thanks to Doug McLean of Plymouth, Dr. Larry Spencer, and Dr. Lisa Doner. And finally, a special thanks to all of those citizens who, over the years, have fought to maintain the Asquam-Chemaki River and the Asquam-Chemaki Valley and the Pemigewasset River and the Pemigewasset Valley.